The word of the day today is transitory. Oh, wait, no. No, it's not.
It's probably a good time to retire that word and try to explain more clearly what we mean.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 30th of November. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. So Jay Powell, it appears, has changed his mind. I could play you some more audio from the Fed chair and his testimony on Capitol Hill today, but really, there are just two things you need to know about it. Number one, the virus. So say both Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, his co-testimony giver today. The virus is still in charge of this economy. So there's that. Number two, and this is actually the news, Powell is pretty clear now that inflation and controlling it have bumped up to the top of the Fed's list of things to do. And in fact, that he is now open to speeding up how quickly the Fed pulls back on its big bond buying program. And that, in turn, was the greater part of the stock market agita today. And now you're up to speed. The lesser part of the agita, if you will, was what the Omicron variant is going to mean for economic activity, which is shorthand for how consumers are going to react to it. In a related item, we learned this morning that consumer confidence ticked down a bit in November. The Conference Board said so today. And that decline, which lags, right, it's backward looking, that decline was driven mostly by inflation worries and a little bit by the Delta variant. So Marketplace's Justin Ho has more now on Omicron confidence.
If virus cases spike and if governments impose restrictions, Lynn Franco at the Conference Board says it's safe to say
that could dampen consumer confidence in the months ahead.
Franco says consumers might spend less, especially on in-person services, which are the most vulnerable to a surge of COVID infections.
That's going to impact, the entertainment industry, travel, leisure, and so forth.
Thing is, the emergence of the Delta variant this summer didn't really dampen consumers' increasing enthusiasm for that kind of spending, says Tim Quinlan, senior economist at Wells Fargo.
That kind of weighed on what was expected to be a big surge in services spending this summer. And while Delta certainly dented that, it didn't stop it.
Consumer confidence doesn't always turn on a dime. Quinlan says other factors could actually help mitigate any downturn in confidence. For instance, vaccination rates are higher now than they were when Delta emerged, and the job market is strong.
You've never had a greater share of consumers agree that jobs are as plentiful as they are today.
We'll have to wait several weeks to learn about Omicron's effect on consumer confidence. Lizanne Saunders is chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab, a current Marketplace underwriter. She says she'll be watching other indicators in the meantime.
There are real-time mobility-based metrics, box office receipts, open table seated diners, New York City subway turnstiles, TSA traveler throughput.
Those indicators, Saunders says, will give us a sense of how consumers are reacting before the Consumer Confidence Index does. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Tis the season for buying, or increasingly buying now and paying later. A report out this morning from Adobe Analytics says purchases through Buy Now, Pay Later platforms were up more than 20% on Cyber Monday, or yesterday, as we call it around here. That's up 20% from last year. BNPL in the vernacular are financial companies that partner with retailers to let customers pay in installments, usually without a credit check. Kind of like layaway, except you get the goods before you make all the payments. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab explains what's going on there.
Back when it was called layaway, people didn't exactly brag about using payment programs. But today on social media, there are buy now, pay later video trends. TikToks with captions that say something like, when you tell them you only spent $25, but that was just the first payment, set to Taylor Swift songs. I said no
one has to know what we do. But yeah, I think it's an entirely different generation that's using buy now, pay later. They probably don't even know what layaway was.
Joel Rampolt at Alex Partners says millennials and Gen Z are the biggest users. And the way they talk about payment programs shows they have a different attitude about them, that they're using them as a budgeting alternative to credit cards they may be scared of or may not have access to. In fact, almost 90% of payments processed by the platform Afterpay are made with debit cards. Zahir Khoja is the North America General Manager.
This is telling you that the consumer wants to use the money that they have.
And hopefully they do have that money, because Afterpay customers usually spend more of it. Khoja says average shopping carts increased by 20% at clothing retailers with Afterpay. Sheridan Trent at the Straw Hecker Group says most of the uptick in buy now, pay later has to do with the pandemic explosion in online shopping.
If you're doing more of your shopping online, it presents more of an opportunity to use buy now, pay later.
There's also the push this year to shop earlier instead of spreading purchases and finances out over the season. And there's the economic uncertainty households have been facing during the pandemic.
And so I think this seems like one way to try to keep a cushion in your account.
Trent says these payment programs can be a good alternative for some, as long as they keep track of payment schedules. Otherwise, they may be hit with penalties. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, nope, nuh-uh, no thanks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I think it's fair to say that the business model for news in this economy is challenged in this digital age. Low barriers to entry, private equity firms snapping up and stripping down local newspapers. You know the stories. They're 10 or 20 years old by now. Less familiar, because it's newer, is a company called Substack, built on the premise that readers and writers are better served by a direct-to-consumer paid subscription newsletter model. Substack has lured some big names, and it hit a million paid subscribers last month. Chris Best is the co-founder, also the CEO. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I've got like an embarrassing number of not just newsletters, but unopened and unread newsletters in my inbox. And I need you to help me understand why we need more in this world.
Don't be embarrassed. That's a totally normal, Okay. Totally normal state of affairs. The problem that people have today is not, I don't have enough things to read. It's that I have limited time to spend on all the things that I care about. How can I allocate my attention better? Having a direct relationship with writers who you trust is a way to do that. It's asking someone to curate some of your time.
What is your company's job in curating those writers, though, right? Because there have been some criticisms of Substack about, you know, letting whoever wants to say whatever they want to do. And I don't want to get into the whole slippery slope of First Amendment and moderation and the problems that Facebook and Twitter are having. But what is your job in that trust framework?
So we see our job and the fundamental benefit of our platform as putting writers and readers in charge. So whereas, you know, if you go to your Twitter feed or your Facebook feed or your various sort of attention monster social apps, they're trying to like decide for you what to see. Whereas the whole idea of Substack is returning power to writers and readers. And so we take a very strong stance kind of in favor of freedom of the press and letting writers and readers decide for themselves how to set up those relationships.
Those writers, though, have to, and look, the big name writers on Substack, you find that they're doing really well dollar-wise, but they also have to be their own marketing department and their own finance team, and they have to work on other things besides, oh, I don't know, writing, you know?
Yeah, this was actually one of the, our goal with Substack is, as a writer, we can tell you, we'll do everything for you except the hard part. We kind of want to make a platform that makes the rest of that stuff as easy as possible and kind of vanish into the background, which doesn't mean that you don't have to, you know, you don't have to do marketing or any of these things, but we kind of want to make that on autopilot as much as possible.
About that vanish into the background thing, Substack, the company, you know, pops up in the news every now and then for whatever it is. And I wonder how you feel about your company being part of the story, setting aside the free publicity thing, but your company being part of the story as opposed to the writers and what they're doing.
You know, we always try to put the writers at the center of the story because we think the writers are the hero of the story. At the same time, you know, if there's to the extent that there's blame, we're willing to take some of the blame sometimes, right? We made Substack knowing that we were running towards the fire on a bunch of problems. And so we accept if people have opinions about Substack.
You're not a media guy, right? You're a tech guy. How did this happen that you're running what is fundamentally a media company now?
I'm not sure I would categorize Substack as a media company.
Really?
I think we're almost
say more about that, because that's really interesting.
I'd say we're almost the thing that's enabling a million media companies to bloom. Like, the benefit of Substack is every writer has essentially their own media company. They're their own independent thing. They own their audience. They own their work. The way that I got here is I've always believed that what you read matters. It shapes how you think. It shapes how you see the world. And so great writing is inherently valuable. And I've always been kind of a tech and product nerd. I love building things. But I was trying to write an essay about this thing. So I was like, writing's valuable. I should write. And I sent it to my friend Hamish, who is a writer himself. And it was in my conversation with him that the idea for Substack and kind of the ethos of it was born. And I think you need the fusion of both of those things to make something like Substack.
Writing, as I'm sure you've discovered, is hard. But look, on that great writing is valuable thing, what is your company's role in ensuring that the writing on Substack is valuable? You know what I mean?
The way that we think of this is that our job for readers is not to go to them and say, hey, here's the kind of stuff you should be reading. Right? Our job is not to go to you and say, hey, you need to eat your vegetables. We're going to give you the tools to make this decision for yourself in the best way possible. And if people choose to read things that aren't the things that we would choose for them to read, I'm actually okay with that. I think that's good.
All right. So I started with my inbox confession. How many emails, newsletters do you have sitting in your inbox?
I'm an inbox zero type, so
no.
I clear them out. I can't read them all.
Oh, well, all right. Well, we can all just delete, man. Come on. That's not.
Well, you got to get off the, like, don't just leave it there. Don't tell yourself you're going to go back to it.
That's right. Not. That's fair. You are absolutely not. Chris Best, co-founder, also the CEO of Substack. Chris, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We talk a lot about the energy transition in this economy. You are going to hear more later in the show, in fact, today. But for all of that talk, we still use tons of fossil fuels, and not just oil and natural gas. Coal stockpiles at American power plants are now the lowest they've been since the 1970s, while coal prices are the highest they've been in more than a decade. Coal producers, being in the business of coal as they are trying to ramp up production as fast as they can. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler explains, it is not just as simple as flipping a switch.
Years of cheap natural gas coupled with cheaper wind and solar production has rendered coal the odd fossil fuel out. Seth Feaster at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis says even when prices spike like they're doing now, investors just aren't that excited about spending on coal.
Coal producers are reluctant in many ways to ramp up production because doing that is capital intensive. It takes a lot of money to really boost production.
Recent higher than normal natural gas prices are boosting coal demand, but who knows how long that's going to last. Ian Lang, director of the Mineral Energy Economics Program at the Colorado School of Mines, says if these high coal prices last even a little bit longer, though, private equity firms might come calling.
Eventually, someone's going to say, look, there's money to be made here, right? Like, people are selling out their 2022 production. So, you know, let's jump in.
But he says another issue limiting a ramp up of coal production in the U.S. is that this industry is having the same labor shortages that many other sectors are feeling right now. That and the long-term prospects of a life in the coal mines isn't that appealing for many young people. Sonia Carley at Indiana University says some in rural coal communities actually see this as a way to redefine their towns.
I think that some younger generations see this as an opportunity to be a part of, you know, future change.
But she says communities need to think broader than jobs in wind and solar to make up for coal. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we believe our technology is the best.
You gotta believe, you know? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's. Dow Industrial's negative 652 points today, 1 8/10%, 34,483. The NASDAQ down 245 on the point scale, 1.5%, 15,537. The S&P 500 subtracted 88, about 1.9%, 45.67 there. Andy Euler took a look at the coal industry, so some coal facts. How about that? Courtesy of the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Last year, the average number of coal mining industry employees during the year, just above 42,000. That's in a labor force of like 163 million-ish or so. Wyoming is the largest coal-producing state in the United States. If you had West Virginia, you'd be wrong. Leading coal-producing company, Peabody Energy, responsible for about 20% of U.S. production last year. Peabody shares, by the way, burned off 6.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Economists and policymakers, Janet Yellen and Jay Powell among them, by the way, like to use what's called core inflation when they talk about rising prices, a measurement that strips out food and energy prices. The catch, of course, is that everybody uses energy and food. So with inflation at a three-decade high, food is what a lot of people are thinking about. The price of a gallon of milk or a pork roast or a four-pack of frozen vegan burgers. And those prices are slamming household budgets, also food assistance programs, too. Food banks and pantries have faced far higher demand throughout this pandemic. And now, with those rising food costs, their resources are being stretched even more, as Marketplace's Savannah Maher reports.
A long line of people stretches down Broadway Boulevard in Albuquerque and ends at the doors of Storehouse New Mexico, where one of the food bank's employees is checking folks in.
We have your ID inside already?
Yeah.
All right. How about you guys? We have your ID inside already?
Lots of longtime clients are here for this Friday distribution. Others, like Gwen Nelson, started coming to the Storehouse recently.
This is my second time.
Nelson lives on disability benefits that she says typically cover her monthly grocery bill. But since about mid-October, she's had to seek extra help.
Everything has gone up. I had to apply for food stamps. Have to hit a couple food banks a month to get by.
Michael Broward, who's retired and also on a fixed income, says his benefits haven't been stretching as far either.
I notice everything is much more expensive.
A volunteer hands him a box of free groceries.
Here you go, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're
I appreciate
welcome.
It.
Which he says takes some of the pressure off.
So, let's see what we got. Okay, so it looks like wheat flour, peanut butter. There's raisins, there's spaghetti.
Plenty of shelf-stable foods and a few pieces of fruit, but no fresh vegetables.
Well, when it's difficult for the food pantry to get any produce, they end up going without.
Jill Beetz is the communications director with the Storehouse. She says the rising cost of food is hitting the organization from all directions.
It's more expensive and harder for us to get items. And because dollars aren't going as far as the grocery store, we have more clients turning to the food pantry for food.
And this all starts with, you guessed it, supply chain disruptions. Erkut Sonmez studies food supply chains at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. When it comes to fruits and vegetables, he says farms are churning out plenty.
Farmers had a very difficult time to find labor to harvest their fresh produce. And this led to incredible amount of produce not being harvested.
Then there's limited capacity to process, package, and transport the produce that does get harvested, and stiff competition to buy it wholesale.
There's a limited availability. You know, we have apples, but not too many. Who's going to get it?
Sonmez says the largest chain grocery stores have the most purchasing power.
Then there are the smaller grocery chains or the neighborhood grocers, right? Then it becomes the food banks.
They're stuck at the back of the line when it comes to wholesale purchasing of all foods, not just fruits and vegetables. And Sonmez says fewer and fewer donations are coming in. Since restaurants and grocery stores can't stock up as much as they'd like, they're managing their inventory more efficiently and have less to give away.
Now it's going to be really a rationing game.
It hasn't come to a rationing game yet at Storehouse New Mexico. There are enough donated beans, grains, and canned vegetables to pack into boxes for today's clients.
You know, it's been steady enough that we're able to feed the households that come in.
But Jill Beetz says the food bank isn't as well stocked for the future as she'd like.
Our shelves are normally completely full. They're not so full right now. You can see a lot of the wall behind things.
She says the storehouse has been bracing for the holidays, when demand for help tends to spike. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
A detour now into the industrial chemistry of a carbon-neutral economy. Hydrogen is the fuel of choice today. It can be widely used in industrial applications and conceivably in heavy transport, too, in trucks and trains, ships and planes. We're talking specifically here about green hydrogen, hydrogen made through electrolysis, which is a process made green if you pass electricity generated by wind or solar power through water, H2O, right? And as it happens, the world's largest manufacturer of electrolyzers is a company called ITM Power, and it is based in Sheffield, in the north of England, whence Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
If the scramble to generate green hydrogen is like an old-fashioned gold rush, these guys are making the picks and shovels. Or at least the 21st century equivalent. They're building electrolyzers that pass a current through water, separating the hydrogen from the oxygen. Business is booming.
ITM Power has grown very rapidly over the last couple of years.
CEO Graham Cooley.
We moved from a valuation a couple of years ago of around 100 million to a valuation today which is closer to 2.7 billion.
A 27-fold increase to more than $3.5 billion. The company's not actually making a profit at the moment, but Cooley says the pay dirt is in sight. This plant is currently the largest of its kind in the world, and yet the International Energy Agency estimates that if the planet is to reach net zero carbon emissions by the middle of the century, it'll need 3,500 times the green electrolyzing capacity this plant can produce.
So it's a phenomenal market growth going on. That's approaching $2 trillion of market, and it's a genuinely global market.
ITM Power is planning to expand production fivefold within the next 3 years and believes it's well placed to lead the field as a global electrolyzer manufacturer. It does have at least one major rival in Germany, but commercial director Barry Cunliffe is quietly confident.
Yes, we do have competition in the world, but we believe our technology is the best. We would hope to keep ahead of the game.
But this doesn't mean that Britain will necessarily become a leading producer of green hydrogen itself. Boris Johnson's pledge to turn the UK into the Qatar of hydrogen isn't a shoo-in.
There are many countries, in addition to the UK, that are looking to become the Qatar of hydrogen.
Bridget van Dorsten of energy consulting firm Wood Mackenzie. She says the biggest centres of green hydrogen production will be places where renewable energy is cheapest.
There are definitely countries like Saudi and Qatar themselves who have lower cost of renewable electricity numbers than the UK.
Reliable sunshine and regular trade winds in the Gulf apparently trump the UK's abundant but relatively expensive offshore wind power. The Qatar of hydrogen is more likely to be Qatar. But none of this should perturb the company selling the kit that transforms wind and solar into the dream green fuel.
At ITM Power, from our world-leading gigafactory in Sheffield, England, we are pioneering how green hydrogen is created.
ITM Power is confident demand for its electrolyzers will soar around the world along with its profits as the green hydrogen bonanza gets underway. Don't forget, selling picks and shovels was the surest way to make money during a gold rush. In Sheffield, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, kind of a bookend to Kristen Schwab's report on BNPL sales on Cyber Monday. I mean, yesterday. Bugs me, Cyber Monday, I don't know. Anyway, Adobe Analytics did find buy now, pay later purchases were up a bunch from last year. You know what wasn't up, though? Overall online Cyber Monday purchases. Adobe says online purchases yesterday were down 1.5% from a year ago. First decline in the decade or so that Adobe's been keeping track. All right, we're gone, but here's your moment of economic context. One more from that Adobe report, and then we'll stop. Shoppers yesterday found items to be out of stock 258% more often than they did 2 years ago. The last holidays, of course, from the before times. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.